For Thursday, sunny and highs 83 to 87, winds from the southeast 5 to 10, gusting higher. More news is next.
Very excited to be a part of something that is going to make America stronger, safer, and more prosperous.
Well, it took all night, but Senate Republicans have narrowly passed their big tax and spending bill.
It's Tuesday, July 1st, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Today is the last official day of USAID as the State Department absorbs what's left of the agency.
By letting the international system collapse, we are going to increase the pressure on our borders. It's madness to have destroyed the system.
Also, we explain the controversy around an ingredient found in some flu shots.
Meanwhile, scientists say some bacteria in our gut can soak up forever chemicals, or PFAS.
And a new memoir from comedian and TV writer Tamara Yahia.
If it wasn't for writing this book, I don't think I would have properly processed my life.
First, the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Trump is celebrating Senate passage of the tax cuts and spending cut measure he calls the One Big Beautiful Bill. As NPR's Tamara Keith explains, it now heads to the House of Representatives either for final passage or to make additional changes.
Some House Republicans say they have concerns with the Senate version of the bill, but President Trump said he wasn't worried about it.
It's a great bill. There is something for everyone, and I think it's going to go very nicely in the House. Actually, I think it will be easier in the House than it was in the Senate.
He also dismissed independent estimates that the bill could lead to nearly 12 million Americans losing health coverage. The bill only passed the Senate because Vice President J.D. Vance broke a tie. Republicans face similarly tight margins in the House, but Trump is pushing to have it on his desk by July 4th. Tamara Keith, NPR News, The White House.
California leaders have approved sweeping changes to a powerful decades-old environmental law. Supporters of the changes say it'll help address the state's housing shortage. Member station KQED in San Francisco, Laura Cliven says more.
The new laws will make it easier to build housing in urban centers and exempt several types of projects from environmental review, like farmworker housing and child care centers. State Assembly member Buffy Wicks authored part of the legislation.
It's not going to solve all of our housing problems, but it is going to remove the single biggest impediment to building environmentally friendly housing in California.
The changes will also make it easier to construct some types of manufacturing facilities like those making semiconductors. Environmental groups warn the reforms could put public health, especially in disadvantaged communities, at risk. For NPR News, I'm Laura Clivens.
So long for an extra charge for eggs at Waffle House. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the 24-hour breakfast chain is dropping its egg surcharge and assigned egg supplies are rebounding.
Waffle House imposed the 50-cent per egg surcharge back in February when a widespread outbreak of avian flu forced the culling of tens of millions of egg-laying chickens and sent prices through the roof. It takes months for egg farmers to rebuild their flocks, but they are making progress. Retail egg prices fell nearly 16% in the last 2 months, although they're still up from a year ago. Waffle House quietly dropped its surcharge in June, but waited until now to announce the move. In a social media post, the chain said the egg surcharge is officially off the menu. Thanks for understanding. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell is continuing to maintain his position the central bank will hold off on making changes to interest rates. Powell repeating his view the Fed's concerned about inflation picking up this summer in part due to the Trump administration's tariff policies. The White House has been pushing Powell to cut rates. You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Secretary of State Marco Rubio hosted his counterparts from India, Japan, and Australia at the State Department today. He says he wants to turn this diplomatic partnership, the so-called Quad, into a vehicle of action. More from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
Secretary Rubio has now hosted representatives from this quad of countries two times at the State Department, but he says he wants the partnership to be more than just having meetings about security and development.
And that's the next step in this great partnership, is to actually begin to see concrete actions and steps being taken in conjunction with one another, in coordination with one another, in partnership with one another.
The foreign ministers all spoke briefly in public, touting this partnership too. None mentioned their concerns about the Trump administration's tariff policies. Australia's foreign minister says they're stronger when they work together. India is planning for a Quad summit later this year. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The University of Pennsylvania says it's banning transgender women from women's athletics, the move part of a settlement by the Ivy League school to resolve a civil rights case that found the school violated the rights of female athletes. Case focused on Leah Thomas, a transgender swimmer who competed in 2022 and won a Division I title. In addition to the voluntary agreement, Penn also says it will restore all individual Division I swimming records and titles to female athletes who lost to Thomas. Crude oil futures prices edged higher today as investors looked at positive indicators and await an August OPEC meeting. Oil up 34 cents a barrel to $65.45 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
6 minutes after 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to People Powered KAXC. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Dale's Auto Body, serving the auto body needs of Grand Rapids and surrounding communities since 1984. Performing auto body and collision repair as well as auto glass replacement, dedicated to getting you back on the road after an accident. More information at dalesautobodyinc.com. Partly cloudy overnight, lows 59 to 63. Tomorrow, slight chance of showers in the afternoon with highs in the low to mid 80s.
Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. After a marathon overnight session, Senate Republicans narrowly passed their sweeping tax and spending bill today. Senate Majority Leader John Thune called it a historic day for the country.
We're very excited to be a part of something that is going to make America stronger, safer, and more prosperous.
NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh joins us now from the Capitol. Hi, Deirdre.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so after all the negotiation, how did Republican leaders finally manage to get this bill through?
It was a real squeaker. Vice President J.D. Vance had to come up and break the tie. With their 53-seat majority, Republican leaders could only afford to lose 3 votes, and they did. Susan Collins of Maine, Rand Paul of Kentucky, and Tom Tillis of North Carolina all voted no. Mm-hmm. There was just immense political pressure from President Trump and from the Republican base on lawmakers to get this done. This represents the president's domestic agenda. The president also created this political deadline to get it done by July 4th. It's not really a real deadline, but it just acted as a forcing mechanism.
Okay. We'll talk about the key components of this bill. Like, what's in there exactly?
You know, tax cuts are really the heart of this bill. The 2017 Trump tax cuts that are going to expire at the end of this year are now made permanent as part of this package. It also adds some new temporary tax breaks, like no tax on tips, no tax on overtime. The bill includes an infusion of billions of dollars for border enforcement, for the military. And to offset the cost of those tax cuts, there are spending cuts to a big range of programs. For example, Republicans rolled back green energy tax breaks. They cut nutrition programs. But in the end, the deciding vote really hinged on the issue of Medicaid. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski raised concerns about the cuts to that health care program for low-income, disabled, and elderly Americans. In the bill, there are nearly $1 trillion of cuts to Medicaid. It adds new work requirements and changes the way states pay for the programs and would shift costs to the states. But Murkowski ultimately voted yes.
Wait, but how? Because, I mean, she had so many issues with this bill. How did they get Murkowski on board finally?
They gave her something she asked for. She wanted more money and a special fund set aside to help rural hospitals. It doubled and went from $25 billion to $50 billion over 5 years. They also made some changes to the work requirements, added to nutrition programs. Murkowski told reporters this was an agonizing decision. She didn't like the bill, but she felt like the only other option was to kill it, and she supported the tax cuts.
I needed help, and I worked to get that every single day. And did I get everything that I wanted? Absolutely not.
Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who complained about the spending in the bill, really directly criticized Murkowski today.
Well, the bill got more expensive. To get her vote, there had to be a purchasing of her vote, and so there was billions and billions of dollars given to her.
But Murkowski pushed back at Senator Paul, said she was working to represent Alaskans.
Okay, so now this bill bounces over to the House. I mean, do you think they will be able to pass it by President Trump's July 4th deadline at this point?
You know, I think it's going to be another squeaker in the House. Several House Republicans are complaining about the changes in the Senate. Conservatives don't like that the Senate bill is more expensive than the version that they passed. Moderates don't like the steeper Medicaid cuts in this package. But again, there is going to be huge pressure on House Republicans to get this done tomorrow. Any wavering Republican can just look at what happened to Senator Tillis. He came out against the Senate bill and the president lashed out on him, attacked him, and vowed to support a primary challenger. Tillis decided the next day not to run for re-election. Just like the Senate, House Speaker Mike Johnson can only afford to lose 3 votes. Mm-hmm. I would expect the president will be lobbying a lot of members. And again, it's going to be close.
That is NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Thank you, Deirdre.
Thanks, Elsa.
The massive cuts the Trump administration has made to the U.S. Agency for International Development could result in 14 million deaths over the next 5 years. That's according to a new study released just as USAID shuts down. Today is its last official day. What remains of it will be folded into the State Department. Reporter Ari Daniel has been talking with former high-level officials from USAID who tell him they believe that shuttering the agency is irresponsible.
To Andrew Natsios, famine is personal.
My great-uncle died during the Nazi occupation of Greece from the Greek famine that killed 300,000 or 400,000 people. So there's a tradition in our family of sensitivity to food emergencies in particular.
This history helped lead Natsios to work in the field of development. From 2001 to 2006, he served as the USAID administrator under George W. Bush, a time when Natsios says deaths due to famine were declining.
And that's because of the evolution of humanitarian response in the world, which is dominated by USAID.
The agency has helped predict and respond to food emergencies. But now that what remains of USAID has been moved to the State Department, Natsios worries the infrastructure and personnel for running complex global aid programs, like those that address famine, simply aren't there.
I think the State Department's the finest diplomatic institution in the world. However, it's not an aid institution. Who is going to run this system? Santa Claus?
Natsios says when there's a famine or a disease outbreak or conflict, people are forced from their homes, and he worries that the decimation of USAID has eliminated a crucial toolset used to handle such crises.
So by letting the international system collapse, we are going to increase the pressure on our borders. It's not what President Trump wanted, but that's what's going to happen. It's madness to have destroyed the system.
Since January, the agency has had 83% of its programs cut, and it's hemorrhaged 94% of its some 13,000 staff members. Susan Reichle worked as a senior foreign service officer with USAID under 5 presidents, both Democratic and Republican.
We are losing people that have developed decades of experience in how to not just manage these really important life-saving programs, but also how to build trust with our partners on the ground.
Reichle now runs the Aid Transition Alliance, an initiative that supports former and current USAID employees.
We are celebrating our staff. We are not mourning our staff. They are deeply patriotic public servants.
Reichle says she would have welcomed a thorough review of foreign assistance by the State Department, even if it had come to the same conclusions. But she finds the current approach hasty and reckless.
The way it's being done now, as an utter train wreck and a waste of U.S. taxpayer dollars.
In a statement from February, the State Department said, quote, USAID has long strayed from its original mission of responsibly advancing American interests abroad. And today, Secretary of State Marco Rubio issued a statement that this day marks a new era prioritizing, quote, trade over aid, opportunity over dependency, and investment over assistance.
The end of USAID is heartbreaking.
Atul Gawande led global health at the agency during the Biden administration.
It's arguably saved more lives per dollar than any other agency.
He's hopeful that the U.S.'s commitment to humanitarian development will endure. But Gawande acknowledges that USAID, as the world knew it, will never return.
You can't rebuild that network built up over 60 years and destroyed in a matter of weeks.
For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wild card deck and answers a big question about their life. Some people will always associate actor Kyle MacLachlan with director David Lynch. They worked together on projects like Blue Velvet and Twin Peaks, but he's probably equally beloved for his roles in everything from Sex and the City to Portlandia to this year's Overcompensating. On this week's Wild Card, Kyle MacLachlan spoke to NPR's Rachel Martin about his experience in his first movie, David Lynch's 1984 version of Dune. This conversation was recorded in front of a live audience in Seattle.
How do you manage envy?
How do I manage envy? Oh, this is a tough one for me. I'm rarely envious.
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. There's just something about you I could tell. Really?
But, yes. I just try to be a good person. I try to be generous. That's what I do. I just, you know, I said, good for you. It's sort of a gratitude sort of thing.
I mean, I God, start with are that. You that perfect?
No. I don't say it succeeds. Oh. But that's where I try to come from, you know?
Yeah.
I remember I've been cast in Dune, right? I'm in Mexico City. It's a lead role in a huge movie out of school. And I'm like, and I meet Sting, who's also in the movie. I wanted that guy's life. And I had a good life going. And I was like, damn, he's going on tour. He was going on the Synchronicity tour. He got to travel the world in a band and like play music and just be cool.
You were envious of Sting.
Yeah, I was. Yeah. Then my wife told me she went to see the movie not because of me, because of Sting.
I mean, yeah.
I still tease her to this day. She had no idea who I was, but Sting. I mean, it was Sting. I'll never be as cool as Sting.
Out of the goodness of your heart, you were pleased for Sting and his many successes.
I was sort of pleased for Sting. Yeah, no, he's a great guy. We had fun together. Yeah, he's a good person. Good person.
I mean, he did do this one album. It was kind of like on a mandolin. I don't think it was that good.
Oh, okay. That makes me feel a lot better.
He's not perfect.
Thank you.
And you can hear that full conversation on the Wild Card podcast.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:18. Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Ahead, Elsa Chang talks with Tamara Yaja about her memoir, Cry for Me, Argentina, My Life as a Failed Child Star and Growing Up with Her Unconventional Family in the U.S. and Argentina. At 5:30, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And coming up at 7, Heather Kidd is your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. And we receive support from the state of Minnesota. Partly cloudy tonight, lows 59 to 63, slight chance of showers. And tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 80s. And again, slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. For Thursday, sunny, highs 83 to 87. Winds from the southeast, 5 to 10, gusting higher. The Loon Country Arts Building in Bemidji is closed due to storm damage, but they will hold a creative cafe this Saturday, July 5th from 1 to 3 at Beltrami County History Center. Artist Kathy Sanders will help you create a patriotic tile trivet. And Grand Rapids Arts invites you to the First Thursday Art Walk this month. On Thursday, July 3rd, from 4 to 7, see art and artists at various locations throughout town, including the McCrossey Arts Center and Old Central School. Find a full list at grandrapidsarts.org. Find the Up North Guide to the 4th at KAXC.org. Our news team has put together a comprehensive guide to Northern Minnesota's fireworks and parades. That is at KAXC.org. If we're missing your local event, email us, news@KAXC.org. More news is next.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The way comedian and TV writer Tamara Yahia tells her life story, it was a chaotic mess from the very start. Surrounded by a family who acted, to use her word, insane. Stuck between two cultures as she bounced back and forth between Argentina and America. Robbed of the chance to become an Argentine child star precisely because her parents couldn't stay planted. But you can hear her laughing out loud as she recounts these brutal years in her new memoir called Cry for Me, Argentina, My Life as a Failed Child Star. Tamara Yahia joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Elsa.
Hi.
I made it through.
You did. So you tell in this book how you figured out at this very early age how much you wanted to be on stage. And there is this key moment that I want to talk to you about. You were 9 years old performing at your school's talent show.
Oh,
it was
God.
A lip sync of Madonna's Like a Prayer. Went all out, like you had props, a custom-made costume, and 3 minutes into your performance, the choir comes in.
Let the choir sing when you call my name.
And I will let you take it from here.
At that point, I stood center stage, grabbed the collar of my American flag shirt, and ripped it off just like strippers do in the movies via a series of Velcro strips that Bubba had sewn onto the sides for me. The shirt tore off perfectly, like I had rehearsed it. And then I stood there under that spotlight, a 9-year-old wearing nothing but a garter belt, beige underwear that made me appear to be nude, and a tiny lace bralette, gazing out at an audience that looked like a truck was about to run them over. And I was the happiest I'd ever been in my life.
Oh, what I would give to see the expression on all those adults' faces.
Yes, and to mention, it was a Hebrew school.
Oh, I love it. I love it. Okay, so tell us why this was such a crucial moment to you.
You know, it was one of the loneliest times of my life. We had moved back from the United States to Argentina. I had no friends. I had no confidence. And I discovered Madonna on TV. I remember her La Isla Bonita music video coming on, and she sang in English and in Spanish, which was like a bridge between the two cultures. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be Madonna.
Because you too were bridging two cultures.
I was. And so I felt seen for the first time. And I think as this talent show came up, it was my chance to show the kids that I was cool. And what best thing to do than Madonna? Now, I shouldn't have picked Like a Prayer for this Hebrew school performance.
No, you should have.
Yes.
Well, you know, I'm thinking back to that little girl who was performing Madonna on that stage in front of her Hebrew school community. And as I was reading this book, I was already formulating questions in my mind that I wanted to ask you. And I was trying to decide how to word those questions because, Tamara, there is so much about sex in this mm-hmm. book. And obviously, this being NPR, I have to proceed in such a way to thread the needle. But but can you talk in the most NPR-friendly way possible about the sexual openness in your family?
You know, it's crazy, right? Sex was always talked about, not just with my parents, but my grandparents. Mm-hmm. I write about how our family outings were to drive to the red light district in Buenos Aires to see the sex workers.
Yeah.
Which is crazy.
Right. It was a family excursion.
It was a family excursion with my grandfather on chemotherapy, like dying in the front seat. Uh-huh. I mean, I talk about this in therapy a lot because obviously it's completely unhealthy, but it was what it was. So I was being bombarded by sex at a very early age.
Sexualized images. I mean, did it make you feel that you should be sexualized?
Oh, totally. To me, it was the norm. And I didn't understand it. And, you know, there's a kind of dark chapter in the book where I go into the experiences of being sexualized as a performer, you know, like older men looking up my skirt on the stage. Mm-hmm. And you know what's crazy? I'm just now as an adult starting to process it because for so many years I accepted it and I just didn't think about it.
Well, and also you strove to seek the gaze of men.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would sit at restaurants as a kid, and if men didn't look at me, I found that confusing because it was my go-to.
Yeah.
That's why the book is, as much as it is funny, it is very sad, but I think it's worth writing down and talking to people about because I think so many people may have gone through similar things. Maybe not the exact situation, but you know.
May I ask, though, you are really funny in this book about some very painful, messed up things that happened to you. Mm-hmm. Is it harder then to talk about your past without wielding humor as a tool?
Probably. I never thought about that, but I think it must be a defense mechanism in a way, but also it's what's kept me alive and allowed me to thrive. I always tell my sister, like, we made it through a pretty difficult childhood and like, we're doing really well.
Yeah. You know, you say at one point that, and I'm going to use your words, your unstable and dysfunctional upbringing had you questioning most of your life if you would be able to bring a child into this world and do things differently from the way your parents did. And I'm just curious how writing and talking about your experiences maybe got you closer to wanting to have children.
This book was so healing, Elsa. You know, if it wasn't for writing this book, I don't think I would have properly processed my life. Mm-hmm. And it was right as I finished this book that I realized, you know, what had been holding me back from wanting kids was that fear of not being able to give them stability. And, you know, it's crazy. Like the moment I finished the book, I started trying to have kids. And then I realized I was too old. Not too old, but I was 40 years old and it wouldn't come as easily as I thought.
Well, when it came to that question of whether you could give your children a life that was different from your parents, that you could choose what to borrow from your parents and what to reject from your parents, what gave you the confidence that you could hold back in the ways you wanted and give in the ways that you wanted?
It was probably the fact that I could see their mistakes, mm-hmm. but not hang on to the anger, because for so many years, I held on to the anger and resentment towards them for not giving me a more stable childhood. But I think once I let the anger go, I knew I would be capable of breaking the cycle.
Tamara Yahia's new book is called Cry For Me, Argentina. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure and an honor.
Last night I dreamt of San Pedro. Just like I'd never gone, I knew the song. The young girl with...
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 529. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Headwaters Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bemidji. Huff's congregation strives to build bridges with the community and welcomes all to seek truth, practice love, and celebrate life. Learn more at headwatersuu.org. Partly cloudy overnight, lows 59 to 63. Tomorrow, mostly sunny, highs in the low to mid 80s, and about a 30% chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. Governor Tim Walz extended the peacetime emergency in Beltrami County, initially issued Friday after a June 21st storm downed thousands of trees and caused widespread long-term power outages. Beltrami County Emergency Management Director Chris Muller explains what the governor's order means for response in the region.
Right now, debris removal is our top need. We have been having assistance with staffing from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, as well as other agencies that have been coming in to augment our services and support our staff so that they can get some downtime. A number of us also had impacts that we're still trying to clean up, and we're still trying to serve our community, but we also need to get a break so that we can recover in our personal lives as well.
As residents continue to work on the cleanup, Muller reminds them that most area townships aren't providing curbside pickup for tree debris.
Only the city of Bemidji and Northern Township are offering curbside pickup from private property. The rest will be responsible for getting that to the debris sites. We are still trying to figure out if there's any additional resources that may be able to assist in that process, and we will get that announced as quickly as we can make those determinations and identify those resources if they become available.
For small businesses, financial relief is also available. Greater Bemidji has launched the Bemidji Business Rebuild Program. It's a rapid response loan initiative designed to help small businesses get through the storm's aftermath. The program offers 0% interest loans up to $10,000 with no payments required in the first year. Executive Director Dave Hengel says this could help cover urgent needs such as insurance deductibles and temporary relocation costs.
Boy, we're hearing a lot. And certainly, of course, there's the physical damages, lots of roof damages, damages to buildings. But the other part is the loss of produce, loss of food, loss of inventory that might have got damaged.
Hengel says the rapid response loans can help cover those costs that may not be covered by insurance. Interested businesses should contact Hengel at Greater Bemidji for more information. Partners in the program include the city, the chamber, the Northwest Minnesota Foundation, and the Headwaters Regional Development Commission. Food will no longer be shipped from the Second Harvest Food Bank in Grand Rapids after the organization decided to consolidate to one warehouse in Duluth. Megan Buffington has the story.
Second Harvest stresses that its Grand Rapids food shelf remains open, and the organization says the operational change won't affect the quantity, quality, or variety of food. Second Harvest Northland is the second largest food bank operation in the state, distributing food to partner agencies in 15 counties across northeast Minnesota and northwest Wisconsin. The Duluth and Grand Rapids branches merged last year to become Second Harvest Northland. Before the merger, the Duluth branch bought a massive warehouse. The organization says a statewide study revealed excess warehouse space in northern Minnesota, and they chose to consolidate the two food banks in the name of efficiency. Second Harvest says the move will save them $300,000 a year. Leaders say they want to reinvest that money into Grand Rapids, and they're currently surveying food shelf visitors to figure out how to spend it. Director of Philanthropy Tricia Zimmerman says there's no hard date for that investment, but it is their goal.
Now, in saying that, you know that there's always, we're dealing with inflation just like everybody else.
Some volunteers are expressing concerns about the needs of the community being met, with food coming from Duluth and the food shelf having access to less storage space. A Grand Rapids volunteer says they don't have faith Second Harvest will follow through on the reinvestment commitment. The volunteer asked to remain anonymous. They say they haven't seen a lot of transparency or willingness to work with the community. Second Harvest has repeatedly reaffirmed its commitment to the local community and that the warehouse change will not impact local programming. The Grand Rapids Food Shelf is open Mondays and Wednesdays 11 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. and Fridays 9 a.m. to noon. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at WaltonFamilyFoundation.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump was in Florida visiting a new migrant detention facility in the middle of the Everglades. At the same time, Senate Republicans back in Washington narrowly passed Trump's big tax cuts and spending bill. This was the president's reaction when someone in the audience at Trump's event delivered the news.
Oh, thank you. Wow. Thank you. I'm waiting, listening to these wonderful words, and they are music to my ears, but I was also wondering how we're doing, because I know this is prime time. It shows that I care about you because I'm here and I probably should be there.
The bill now heads to the House of Representatives, either for final passage or additional changes. With more on Trump's reaction and the reason for his trip to Florida, we're joined now by NPR's senior White House correspondent, Tamara Keith. Hi, Tam.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, let's start with the bill. President Trump has said he wants it on his desk by the 4th of July. What do you think, Tam? Is he going to get what he wants?
That is up in the air at this point. This bill really does contain the president's entire domestic legislative agenda all bundled together. It's tax cuts. It spends more on immigration enforcement and defense. It raises the debt ceiling, does a whole bunch of other things. But an independent analysis finds it would add trillions to the deficit and could lead to millions of Americans losing their health coverage. And that is creating heartburn among House Republicans who aren't happy with the Senate version. President Trump was asked about that and said he wasn't worried.
It's a great bill. There is something for everyone. And I think it's going to go very nicely in the House. Actually, I think it will be easier in the House than it was in the Senate.
And he was also dismissive of the estimate that nearly 12 million people could lose Medicaid coverage. He said the number would actually be much lower, though it isn't clear what he's basing that on. I will just say the experience thus far with this bill has been that resistance from Republicans melts away in the face of pressure from Trump.
Okay, well, let's talk about Trump's trip to Florida, if you can. He was there to tour, I understand, a new migrant detention facility. Can you tell us more about this place?
Yeah, it's a temporary facility being built on an out-of-use airstrip in the middle of the Everglades. There are repurposed FEMA trailers and huge white tents, complete with air conditioning and beds with interior walls made of chain-link fencing. It was built by the state of Florida, and the state will be reimbursed with FEMA funding. And it's supposed to start housing migrants facing deportation beginning tomorrow and can house up to 3,000 people. President Trump seemed pretty excited about the fact that it is surrounded by alligators and venomous snakes.
It's known as Alligator Alcatraz, which is very appropriate because I looked outside and it's not a place I want to go hiking anytime soon. But very soon, this facility will house some of the most menacing migrants, some of the most vicious people on the planet. We're surrounded by miles of treacherous swampland, and the only way out is really deportation.
He said he hopes that other governors will do the same thing, and even suggested that maybe these sorts of facilities wouldn't be so temporary after all.
Well, how do you think a facility like this fits in with President Trump's approach to immigration overall?
He promised mass deportation, but the numbers haven't been massive so far. The White House says that they need additional Border Patrol and ICE officers that would be funded through the big bill that just passed the Senate today. Mm-hmm. But there's a real emphasis on self-deportation, including at the event today. The president and his allies are working really hard to make it uncomfortable and unappealing for people to stay in the U.S. without legal status. At one point today, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said, "Why would you want to come through Alligator Alcatraz if you could just go home on your own?" Critics argue this is cruel and unusual, and the majority of people swept up on immigration raids at this point aren't hardened criminals, but people who came to the country illegally and have been living and working and raising families in the U.S.
That is NPR's Tamara Keith. Thank you, Tam.
You're welcome.
You might recall that last month, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. overhauled a group of vaccine experts and replaced them with his own handpicked panel. Now, a matter that some vaccine experts thought was long settled has reemerged. An ingredient in some flu shots called thimerosal could be on its way out. It has been absent from most, but not all, flu vaccines for more than two decades. NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin is here to explain what the ingredient is and why it's getting so much attention. Hi, Sydney.
Hi, Ari.
I'd never heard of thimerosal before this panel met. What is it?
So thimerosal is a chemical compound that's about 50% mercury by weight. It has a record of safe and effective use as a preservative in vaccines and medicines since the 1930s. That's according to the Food and Drug Administration. But as you said, it's actually absent from the vast majority of flu shots in the U.S. and has been for 20 years. Today, thimerosal is still used in vials containing multiple doses of the vaccine. Here's Dr. Michelle Fiskus, Chief Clinical Officer of the Association of Immunization Managers.
If you're constantly going in and out of the vial to drop a new dose, you run the risk of getting bacteria or fungus into that vial, and we don't want those vaccines to be contaminated.
Thimerosal's job is to keep the vial from getting contaminated between patients and potentially making someone sick.
So why the push to take it out?
So the question before the meeting of vaccine advisors to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention last week was whether to recommend against using thimerosal-containing vaccines. It's been a theory among people who are concerned about vaccines that thimerosal causes autism, but study after study has shown it doesn't. Nevertheless, thimerosal was removed from most childhood vaccines in 2001. Dr. Jesse Goodman, a former chief scientist at FDA, also points out that even though thimerosal has been largely absent from vaccines for years, autism rates have gone up anyway.
They turned this meeting into solving a problem that doesn't really exist anymore.
The panel did recommend that people get flu shots that don't contain thimerosal, and that could lead to a shift to just flu shots without it.
Is this going to have any impact on how easy it is for people to get vaccinated?
For most people, there would be no change. According to the CDC, 94% of flu shots in the most recent flu season were thimerosal-free or thimerosal-reduced. Single-dose syringes, which is how most flu shots are given, don't need to have thimerosal. That said, the change could present challenges for some health centers. The multi-dose vials are cheaper and take up less space in refrigerators than single-dose syringes do. So they would have to adapt. I also reached out to the two companies that make multi-dose flu shot vials with thimerosal, Sanofi and Seqirus. Both said only a very small number of their doses contain thimerosal, and they'll be able to make enough single-dose vials to handle the upcoming flu season.
So is there any impact at all to this change?
You know, in practice, it would be manageable. But what I'm hearing from people like Goodman and Fiskus is that it's the bigger issue of how vaccine policy is being made. They were concerned that the regular protocols weren't followed when the CDC's advisors voted to recommend this move to the agency. The panel seemed to disregard scientific evidence showing thimerosal doesn't cause harm. Goodman says he's concerned this process will undermine confidence in vaccines in the United States and abroad.
That's NPR Pharmaceuticals correspondent Sydney Lupkin. Thank you.
You bet.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The aquifer that makes agriculture in the Great Plains possible is running out of water, mainly from over-irrigation. That has farmers considering different crops. Kaylin Moore of the Kansas News Service reports.
Western Kansas is sprawling with grain crops, small towns, and essential food and fuel industries. Even hundreds of miles away, ingredients grown in western Kansas are part of everyday life. I'm in rural southwest Kansas, but I asked my coworker Stephen Caranda on the other side of the state near Kansas City to see what he could find at his local grocery store.
All right, I'm going to grab a cart and head on in.
And right away, he started noticing things that were likely from western Kansas.
Whole wheat bread.
Wheat is one of the big ones.
Into the meat section. Oof, lots of beef.
That's very likely from western Kansas, too, one of the country's top beef producers. The list goes on. Soybean oil, corn syrup, milk. All of these products rely on irrigation, which allows dry western Kansas, a state prone to drought, to grow corn, soybeans, and other commodity crops at a large scale. And it's not just Kansas, but a lot of Nebraska and Texas corn crops depend on irrigation. Logan Simon, agronomist for Kansas State University, says that might need to change since the water of the aquifer is tapped at a rate much faster than it can naturally be replenished. So he's been researching alternative crops.
All of the crops that we're looking at here are going to be providing some sort of benefit in the form of a reduction in the water required.
It's not a simple task. Grain elevators and feedlots are built for crops like corn and soybeans, which require billions of gallons of water from irrigation, not per year, but per day. The Oglala Aquifer, the only source of water for this region, has been running dry for decades due to excessive irrigation for crops that need more water than the region receives. It means some areas in Kansas may only have a couple decades of water left. Alex Miller-Shasky is a young farmer in southwest Kansas, and his water supplies have plummeted.
We used to have 20-some wells on the farm, and we're only pumping 4 now.
For farmers like Miller-Shasky, getting creative will keep their farms going. He's been attending an alternative crop school run by Kansas State University. It focuses on crops like canola, black-eyed peas, and cotton as alternatives that grow well here. Southwest Kansas farmer Heath Kane has bought in. He decided for the first time to grow something he's never grown before, a canola crop.
The wheat price was terrible, and I got some limited irrigation, and I was like, well, I wanted to like kind of diversify some of that and not just have all my eggs in one basket.
Growing canola requires about 40% less water than corn, and new biofuel markets fueled by canola have recently spread to Kansas. So if these alternative crops can solve so many problems on the frontier, why don't all farmers just make the switch?
You have to be willing to accept more risk to establish that alternative crop, because there aren't these built-in mechanisms that we usually have.
Agriculture economist Chad Hart from Iowa State University explains that commodity crops like corn and soybeans are the most economically efficient despite their water costs. Plus, crop insurance, government subsidies, and bank loans are all built on traditional crops, not the possible alternatives. Those dollars make up nearly a quarter of a farmer's income.
They insure not only crop farm yields, but they also insure the prices that the farmers will capture.
But despite the risks, the next generation of farmers seem intrigued by the challenge of growing something new. For NPR News, I'm Kaylin Moore in Liberal, Kansas.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48. You're listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6 o'clock, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And at 7 o'clock, Heather Kidd, your volunteer host for On the River, bringing you a great mix of music. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, offering technology for businesses like SmartBiz to manage voice and Wi-Fi services, security cameras, and more. Online at paulbunyan.net. Paul Bunyan Communications, it's right here. And we thank the Lake Country Journal, a lifestyle magazine since 1997, a local publication sharing stories from the heart of Minnesota about the places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. LakeCountryJournal.com. The Minnesota DNR reminds boaters to stay safe while enjoying the water this season. Wear your life jacket and make sure children are wearing theirs. Stay sober and let others know where you are going. And also be aware of the weather. The 14th annual Ironman Car Show is this Saturday from 10 to 2 at the Minnesota Discovery Center in Chisholm. Classic cars and trucks will be along pathways with live music and concessions. Regular museum rates apply. And the city of Cohasset has Wednesday workouts during July and August, starting at 8:30 each Wednesday morning at Tioga Beach. All ages are welcome to take a walk that includes gentle stretching before and afterwards. Wear comfortable shoes and clothing. KAXE's future is on the line. The U.S. House recently voted to rescind federal funding for public media that was already allocated. This goes to the Senate next. Public radio stations like KAXE bring you local information about events, news that matters to you, timely emergency information, and more. Visit protectmypublicmedia.org and tell Congress protect the funding that keeps KAXE and stations like us on the air. We continue with All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration has notified Harvard University that it has violated Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. That section prohibits discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin in programs that get federal assistance. A task force from the Department of Health and Human Services claims Harvard has been, quote, deliberately indifferent and even a willful participant in anti-Semitic harassment of Jewish students, faculty, and staff. This comes after Trump indicated that his administration and the school were making progress at the negotiating table. NPR's domestic extremism correspondent Odette Youssef is here. Hi, Odette.
Hey, Ari.
The administration already froze or canceled more than $2 billion in federal funds for Harvard. Now it's threatening to cut off what remains. Tell us about the new grounds that it is citing for this.
Well, many of the examples it cites of campus hostility towards Jewish and Israeli students, Ari, actually come from Harvard's own investigation. Harvard convened task forces to look at anti-Semitism and anti-Muslim bias at the school. Those reports came out in April. And so the administration is using information that the university found to punish the university. It also only focuses on anti-Semitism, so it doesn't show concern about findings of hostility toward Muslim, Palestinian, or Arab students on campus. But this escalation comes even after Harvard has been credited with improving conditions for Jewish and Israeli students. You know, even the Anti-Defamation League has acknowledged progress in this area, and even called out the Trump administration for, quote, imposing or suggesting extremely severe penalties that don't tie to the issue of reducing anti-Semitism. And so this is where the question comes in, Ari, of what's really the goal here? And it's useful to put it in a larger historical context of attacks on higher education.
Tell us more about that context.
I spoke with Isaac Kamola about this. He teaches political science at Trinity College in Hartford. He says it goes back to the mid-20th century. Access to higher ed really expanded. Colleges were accepting more women, people of color, first generation and low income students, people studying under the GI Bill. And in turn, that led to new areas of study like Black studies and gender studies.
Starting in the 1980s, you get a massive backlash against those kinds of shifts by those who want to reproduce hierarchy. They want to reproduce this vision of America as a white nation, as a white Christian nation, that want to push back against the directions of racial justice that the society was going in general, and higher education played a large role in.
So universities, Ari, kind of became the vanguard in the pursuit of inclusive democracy. And Kamala says, you know, conservative attacks on universities are really like a counter-revolution fighting against that.
And how does that tie back to the issue of anti-Semitism?
Well, Kamala says anti-Semitism is a real and serious issue, but he sees the administration using it for other goals, namely rolling back civil rights, or DEI, as we hear more often now, and rolling back inclusive democracy. This has been incredibly concerning to many whose life's work is to fight anti-Semitism, because they say the administration's goals could actually make the problem worse. The way Jonathan Jacoby of the Nexus Project explained it to me is, he says nothing has been more important to the safety of American Jews than democracy.
Living as a free people in an open society is essentially unprecedented in Jewish history. And it's kept us safe, and our relationships with other Americans have kept us safe. And so standing against the weaponization of anti-Semitism to undermine democracy is part of standing against anti-Semitism.
What does he suggest when it comes to safety concerns of Jewish and Israeli students?
Well, what Jacoby and others have emphasized to me is that the only way is by pursuing policies that make campuses safer for everybody, including Muslim and Arab students, students of color, and women. Because otherwise, singling out Jewish people as uniquely deserving of safety could feed conspiracy narratives, and it could lead to Jews being scapegoated for damage ultimately done to America's higher education system.
NPR's Odette Youssef, thank you.
Thank you.
PFAS, or forever chemicals, are everywhere in our daily lives. These manufactured chemicals show up in our food, our water, consumer products, and they are inside of us. Now, scientists in the UK say we may be able to harness our gut microbiome to eliminate at least some of these chemicals from our bodies. NPR's Will Stone explains.
These PFAS chemicals, and there are thousands of them, show up in the blood of virtually every American. Their effect on our health isn't fully understood, but research has found links to cancer, cardiovascular disease, decreased fertility, and other harms. Kiran Patil is a professor of molecular systems biology at the University of Cambridge. He says there's no easy way to get rid of them.
They're forever chemicals because it's very difficult to attack them chemically.
Scientists are exploring how to remove them from our environment, for example, using harsh chemicals or intense heat.
But of course, you know, we can't apply this process to human bodies to get rid of them.
This is why Patil turned to the bacteria in our gut microbiome. His team has identified certain strains that have a remarkable ability to sop up these chemicals.
To kind of act as a sponge and soak them up inside and store them inside.
Images from his lab show this clearly. Clusters of PFAS molecules stashed in the bacterial cells. The research was published in the journal Nature Microbiology today. Patil's lab ran experiments with mice. Their microbiomes were first colonized by these bacteria strains from the human gut. The scientists saw the bacteria absorb the PFAS, and the animals eventually cleared it when they went to the bathroom.
This natural PFAS removal process, which we did not know before this study, right?
Patil says the next step is to launch clinical trials in humans to see whether probiotics can increase the amount of these PFAS-hungry bacteria. He and his collaborators have started a company to do this.
I think this is a really important finding.
Andrew Patterson is a researcher at Penn State who works on PFAS in the gut microbiome. He says the findings open up a tantalizing possibility, but everything gets a lot more complicated when you jump from mice to humans.
How do you increase those beneficial bacteria through probiotics? I mean, that's quite challenging.
Not to mention there are many PFAS chemicals, and some could act differently.
This certainly teases at that possibility that there's therapeutic benefit. I think without the human trials, it's probably still, you know, a little premature to make that assessment.
But Patterson agrees the research offers a new direction and some hope for tackling a growing problem. Will Stone, NPR News.
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. From the Joyce Foundation, committed to advancing racial equity and economic mobility for the next generation in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It is just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You may find us at KAXC.org or ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. Coming up next, As It Happens, news from a Canadian perspective, and 7 o'clock, Heather Kidd, your volunteer host for On the River, a great mix of music. Partly cloudy tonight, lows 59 to 63, and mostly sunny tomorrow, highs in the low to mid